Any good word there is out there in this world would describe Tina. Tina was the perfect little girl, but unfortunately this perfect little girl had far from a perfect life, and it was a life that was marred with tragedy long before Tina Fontaine had even been born. To fully understand Tina and her story, we have to go back to where it all started, with her grandfather at the end of the 19th century in Canada. Tina's grandfather, like hundreds of other children of the Indigenous people of Canada, were forcibly taken from their homes and placed in what was then called residential schools, under the notion and pretense of assimilation and education. These children were stripped of their identities and their cultures and reformed to fit a more European mindset with Christian values. There was little to no regulation on practices and staffing for these schools, and they became the breeding ground for some of the worst sides of humanity. The children were often abused, both sexually and physically. They were malnourished, and the staff were quick to discipline them. Runaways were beaten, both to deter others from trying to do the same, but mainly as a way for the schools to protect themselves from potential lawsuits and inspections when and if a runaway child would die in the wilderness or would come back gravely injured. Tina's grandfather survived his time in one of these residential schools, but he didn't make it out unscathed. Traumatised and unable to cope with what he'd experienced during his time there, he lived a life full of alcohol abuse and violence. It was in this household, already full of strife, grief and anger, that Tina's father, Eugene Fontaine, was born and spent the most crucial formative years of his life. At the young and tender age of 12, Eugene took off and struck out on his own. He made his way to Winnipeg, over 75 miles or 121 kilometres from the home he'd once known, and there he tried to forge his own path. But what awaited the young boy in Winnipeg was life on the streets, with little to no money, no friends, and nowhere to call his own. And unfortunately, it wasn't long before Eugene followed his father and started drinking to cope. 11 years later, Eugene was still in Winnipeg, still making what he could out of his life and still battling his addictions. But it was then, when he was 23 years old, that he found someone he was willing to fight for and fight with. Valentina Duck and Eugene Fontaine had a lot in common. Valentina was also a member of one of the tribes indigenous to Canada, and her start in life was just as rocky and marred with tragedy as Eugene's had been. The first time it happened, she was only 6 years old. That was when the Manitoba Child and Family Services first came and took Valentina away from her mother. She was eventually returned, but this happened several more times before. When Valentina was only 10 years old, she was permanently removed from her family and her home. What followed thereafter were years of documented abuse. Valentina was sexually abused and exploited by the adults around her, and to cope, she turned to drugs and alcohol. Tragically, the Manitoba Advocate for Children and Youth later came out to say that there were opportunities for people to step in and help Valentina during this crucial period, but very few of these opportunities were ever actually acted upon. It was perhaps the culmination of these missed opportunities that pushed Valentina towards Winnipeg, over 160 miles or 250 kilometres away from her home in Bloodvane First Nation. When Valentina arrived in the city, she was only 12 years old, the same age that Eugene had been, only Valentina had arrived 11 years after he had. When the two met, Valentina was still 12 and Eugene was 23 years old. Valentina was still officially in the system and monitored by Child Protective Services, but they did little to prevent what happened next. Notes in Valentina's records showed that they knew that the relationship that Eugene and Valentina had struck up together had turned sexual, and it also showed that they knew exactly who Eugene was. Eugene's history of drug and alcohol misuse and the violent lifestyle he lived in order to support those addictions were all noted in Valentina's file, as were all the times Valentina had run away from foster care to live with Eugene instead. Only 2 years later, when Valentina was only 14 years old, she gave birth to their first child. Child and Family Services immediately swooped in and removed the child from their care, but Valentina and Eugene continued to see each other despite this. On January 1st of 1999, only a few weeks short of being the third year anniversary of the birth of their first child, the couple had another, a daughter named Tina Fontaine. Tina was quickly followed by another sister, Sarah, but by then another vicious cycle had already been put into place, and a dark history was about to repeat itself. When Tina was only a year old, Child and Family Services removed her from Valentina's home. She was eventually returned, but it happened again just a year later. By then, Valentina and Eugene were living in separate houses, and Child Protective Services placed Tina into Eugene's care. Perhaps he knew that he wouldn't be able to care for his children properly, perhaps it was all just too much for him to handle, but Eugene made the call and had his children placed into the care of his aunt and uncle, Thelma and Joseph Favell, instead of keeping custody of them himself. They took both of his daughters out of Winnipeg and away from the temptations that both of their parents had fallen victim to. The girls spent most of their childhood in a place close to the Sagkeen First Nation, which was where Eugene was from himself. There the girls grew up in peace and stability, and Tina flourished. She did well at school, made and played with many friends, often together on trampolines. Her great-aunt Thelma described Tina as someone with a wonderfully big heart, but tragedy struck at a familiar age and set different wheels in motion. When Tina was only 12 years old, the family received heartbreaking news. Years of living a violent lifestyle fueled by drug and alcohol abuse had finally caught up with Eugene. Two men, also involved in the darker side of Winnipeg, had found Eugene and beaten him to death. He was only 41 years old at the time. The two men who'd beaten him were taken to court, where Tina, who was only 12, had to stand up and read a victim impact statement. Attempts were made to shield her from the exact truth as to what happened to her father, but Thelma later said that Tina had overheard a discussion about the beating and what condition her father's body had been found in. After that, Tina became notably more reserved and withdrawn, especially during the period when she had to put her feelings into words. She was eligible for, but was never offered to, receive grief counselling, and if she had been, it may have changed the direction this young girl started heading in. Her father's court case had brought Tina to Winnipeg, and it also put her in contact with someone in their own destructive path, her mother, Valentina. Thelma had figured this would happen, and before anyone had even stepped foot in Winnipeg, Thelma had called Valentina's caseworker to check up on her situation. Eugene's death had knocked Valentina, but her caseworker said that she was doing well, and she even had custody of the children that she'd had after Tina and Sarah. When asked if it would be appropriate and wise for the girls to be in contact with their mother, Valentina's caseworker gave them the go-ahead. Tina and Sarah made the trip down to Winnipeg, where Tina spoke at her father's trial and his assailants were convicted of manslaughter. And during that time, she reconnected with her mother. The three bonded over their shared experience of losing Eugene, and then the girls went back to live with Thelma and Joseph, but it was clear that Tina was shaken by everything that had happened. Thelma later described the girl that Tina had become then, quote, "She was very hurt, very lost. That's when she drifted away." Tina's grades and attendance in school began to suffer, but perhaps most importantly, she became more distant towards her family. From there, Tina was then suspended from school, frequently got into both verbal and physical altercations, one of them resulting in the police having to be called to calm the situation. By 2014, Child and Family Services were painfully aware that Tina was struggling. They knew that she had run away and had been reported as missing 3 times since Eugene's death, and they had records of her seeking medical attention for self-inflicted wounds, but they didn't step in to help or offer help, despite Thelma and Joseph and other family members asking for it. When Tina was 15, she asked Thelma if she could go and visit her mother in Winnipeg, perhaps thinking that it would be a good thing for the troubled teen to connect with someone who could share her grief. Thelma agreed and helped organise the trip. She gave Tina $50 and a calling card so that they could keep in touch, especially if Tina wanted to come home earlier than planned, and then she sent Tina on her way. Thinking that everything with Valentina was as it had been 3 years prior, Thelma didn't call Valentina's caseworker before sending Tina to visit her. Quote, "This is where I really blame myself," Thelma later said to the press. Quote, "I didn't find out till later she'd lost custody of her kids and she was back on the streets." What Thelma was referring to in that statement was that Valentina had resorted to an old profession to earn her money, and it was one that had caused her to lose custody of her children time and time again. She had to return to survival sex work. Whether that had come as a result of her battle with alcoholism or the two simply came hand in hand is hard to say, but by the time Tina was on her way to visit her mother, Valentina was deep in drink and on the streets once again. Child Protective Services finally stepped in when they realised that Tina was living with Valentina during this period and removed the girl from the home. They first placed her in a hotel and then in a youth shelter, but Tina was still struggling, and now she was in Winnipeg with basically no supervision. Her bed at the shelter was given away when she missed her curfew for a second time, and then Tina simply vanished. She was reported missing on July 31st of 2014, 2 days after she'd lost her place at the shelter, but it wasn't the last time that Tina was seen, and it wasn't the last time Child and Protective Services had custody of her. Tina called her own caseworker on August 5th and asked to be picked up. She was, but she went missing again the very same day. She wasn't seen again until August 8th, when she showed up at another youth shelter. There, the same thing happened again. Only a few short hours after turning up, Tina went missing. Almost unbelievably, 2 police officers stopped a truck with a drunk driver that very same day, only a few hours after Tina had gone missing from the shelter, and Tina was in the truck. The police officers asked for her name, and after finding out who she was, they didn't take her into custody. Tina was allowed to leave, and she was spotted again only a few hours later. This time, she was unconscious and lying in an alleyway. It was 10 in the morning and Tina was unresponsive, but by some stroke of luck, she was found in an alleyway that was close to the University of Winnipeg, and she was quickly taken to the Health Sciences Centre to be treated. Finally, in hospital, Child and Family Services had eyes on Tina again. She told them that she had been spending her time with a 62-year-old man named Raymond Cormier. Her caseworker made a note of his name and took Tina to a new placement when she was medically cleared to leave the hospital. This new placement was in a hotel. Child and Family Services then left. Tina had no adult supervision and she quickly checked out of the hotel. According to a witness, an 18-year-old girl who claimed to have met up with Tina during this period, these days were filled with a patchwork of alcohol abuse and danger. She tried to check Tina into a youth shelter around 2:30 on the morning of August 7th. She'd said that she thought Tina was drunk and asked the staff at the centre to keep an eye on her, but Tina hadn't wanted to stay and she'd left without ever giving the staff her name. This was the shelter that Tina had briefly stayed in before the police had found her inside the truck with the drunk driver. The 18-year-old then hadn't heard from Tina until 8 p.m. that same evening, when Tina reached out to her again after leaving the hotel. The girls stayed another night, hanging out on the streets until the early hours of the following morning, when they were approached by a stranger. The man allegedly offered to buy Tina's services, and she accepted. Her friend, apprehensive and concerned about the whole thing, followed Tina and this man down the streets until she finally lost them in the dark, and that was the last she saw of Tina Fontaine. She was reported as missing again the following day, but this time she didn't show up of her own accord and no one knew where to find her. On August 17th, something wrapped up in plastic and a duvet cover and weighed down with rocks was pulled out of the Red River. Inside was the already badly decomposed body of a teenage girl, but the police had no idea what or who they were looking at. Whilst awaiting DNA results, they opened an investigation and the coroner tried to determine a cause of death, but they didn't get very many answers. Because of the increased speed of decomposition from being in the water, the autopsy told the investigators nothing other than her time of death had probably been sometime on the 10th. But no one could say how Jane Doe had died. And then the DNA results came back and a difficult call had to be made to Thelma and Joseph. The girl was Tina. A girl and a life who shouldn't have slipped through the cracks. What followed was then another lackluster performance from the people who could have made all the difference. Raymond Cormier wasn't arrested for a full year and a half, but even when he was, the result was a true disaster. The prosecution still didn't have a cause of death. They had no motive, no physical forensic evidence, and no eyewitnesses that could directly tie Raymond and Tina together, especially around the time of her death. All they had was an eyewitness who testified that the last time he'd seen Tina, she'd been arguing with Raymond because he'd allegedly sold her bicycle for drug money. Everything hinged on the prosecution charging him with the lesser crime of second-degree murder rather than first-degree, but perhaps, unsurprisingly, Raymond pleaded not guilty anyway. His lawyers then made a very simple but very powerful counter-argument. They said that because the prosecution were unable to provide a cause of death, there was no way to prove that Tina had actually been killed in the first place. And they, unfortunately, had a point. Raymond was found not guilty, and only a few weeks later, the prosecution announced that they wouldn't be submitting an appeal. It was clear that Tina hadn't wrapped herself up and thrown herself in the Red River, but by not providing a cause of death, the prosecution had left their entire case wide open and vulnerable. It was a possibility that Tina had died by accident, and whoever she'd been with at the time had panicked and tried to cover their tracks by hiding her body. But it was entirely possible that Tina had literally given the name of her killer to the authorities herself, but without a cause of death, officially. Nobody could prove anything. Guilty or not, Raymond walked free, potentially someone who took advantage of troubled children, potentially so much more. To this day, we don't know what happened to Tina Fontaine in her final hours on Earth, and we unfortunately probably never will. But that's not the end of her story or her legacy. She was taken to Sag King First Nation and laid to rest beside her father, Eugene. Thelma later said, "I just miss her so much. There's not a day that goes by that I don't think of my baby. That's what she was to me, my baby. I don't have any favourite memories. They're all favourites of mine. Everything about her." But from that difficult pain has at least come some change. The police officers who had Tina and let her go were suspended from the force and later quit, and her death added fuel to an already growing fire. That same year, a study of the number of missing and murdered Indigenous women was finally completed, and later writing on the chilling results of the study, Acting Chief Commissioner David Langtree said, "Once again, our hearts are filled with grief and sadness as we mourn the brutal and senseless murder of an Aboriginal girl. Tina must not disappear into the oblivion of statistics." That call to action was answered 2 years later when Prime Minister Justin Trudeau announced that a national inquiry named Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls would be launched, with the hope of putting an end to cases like Tina's. But again, Tina's legacy didn't end there. As a direct response to Tina's death, a group dedicated to finding evidence and potentially victims in the Red River was formed. Drag the Red mainly works on a volunteer basis, but in the time since its founding with Tina's discovery, they've grown from just a handful of people to literally hundreds. In response to its many failings in Tina's case, the Manitoba Child and Family Services has changed its policy and no longer places children in hotels, and more people from the Indigenous communities across Canada, particularly Winnipeg, have taken things into their own hands by creating more crisis centres and teams dedicated to helping children like Tina Fontaine. With more awareness and more support, hopefully we'll see and turn around in cases like this, and some of society's most vulnerable people will finally be able to walk the streets safely.